Hey, my name is Verlon Brown, and I'm a Lutheran pastor in Seattle, Washington. And my hobby is stand-up comedy, and so I thought I'd talk about it. Today is the fourth day of our series, and today's topic is I hate myself. And self-deprecation is a big one in comedy. And there are people who are have made a good living off of putting themselves down doing stand-up comedy. And so the point of this is to teach you how to do stand-up comedy. So today I'll teach you what you need to know about that. This light is on. Is that necessary? Is that?
No.
It's still on?
No, it's going on.
Okay.
So we'll start off with some Richard Lewis. Who's reading Richard Lewis? All right, read the ones I marked.
Might as well read them all. Richard Lewis on hypochondria. I'm a major hypochondriac. I won't even masturbate anymore. I'm afraid I might give myself something.
Okay. All right, the next one.
Richard Lewis on self-esteem. Low self-esteem sex is bad. Here's the deal. When I have an orgasm, I shriek, I'm sorry! Richard Lewis on Hanukkah. My family wasn't very religious. On Hanukkah, they had a menorah on a dimmer.
Is that it? All right. That's Richard Lewis's take on self-deprecation. The thing about comedy is that excess is good. So the more you can get carried away with something, the better in comedy. That really works well for stand-up. And so the first thing I'm going to do is, I'm trying to figure out how to do this, but I know this is anti-Lutheran.
I hate myself.
Oh, wait. Things I hate. Can you give me a list? Can just yell out things that that you hate personally?
My temper.
Your temper? All right. Anything else?
I'm getting bored easily. Okay. That's a different one.
All right, so if you get up and leave, I don't know why. What's another one?
Baseball caps in church, on guys.
You don't mind if women
not
mind?
On women, yeah.
I don't mind, I guess.
Is this supposed to be about ourselves or about anything?
Yeah, that's what I want.
About yourself.
No, I don't hate myself.
My voice.
I don't hate myself.
My voice.
My hair.
What else?
Lack of hair.
That's always funny.
All right. How about, let me switch this up. Internal psychological stuff, but not on you, on other people. So you don't have to out yourself, but say like, is there something that you don't like on certain people that's, you know?
Like what?
People that think they know it all?
Yeah, okay, know it.
People who are angry all the time for no reason.
People who are happy all the time for no reason.
would have to be right.
Well, those is that different from is that a different from know it all?
That's
yeah.
Is it people who have to have the last word?
Again, part of know it all. Passive aggression.
All right, I gotta stop you.
Me right. First all the time.
No, stop it! He's going to. I lost track. I'm sorry. But all of these are things that a comic would deal with on stage about themselves, and would sort of mine their internal self or things that they hate in order for a laugh. And these would be a setup. I hate my temper. I hate know-it-alls. And then the punch would come in, you would ask, why do you hate know-it-alls? Or why do you hate your temper? Why do you hate your voice? Can you say?
Because it's weak.
Because it's weak. All right, that's a good answer. Not funny yet, but you know, you could say, I hate my voice because it's weak, and then you could say something, act out something, a part of your life, something that has happened to you because of your weak voice, you know. Like you tried to discipline your three-year-old and they wouldn't listen to you. A three-year-old, you know, talk deeper than you. Somehow figure out how to make that funny. You have to address, when you go on stage, you have to address whatever it is that shows up when you stand up, because people are going to pay attention to that, you know. So if you walk on stage and you have fat thighs and everybody can see that, you have to address that. When I do my stand-up, one of the things I used to do is I would get my first thing on stage would say, I'd ask people, you like my shirt? Do you? You like my shirt? I got it at the big and tall section, the big section. When you're big, you're always looking for something to cover your stomach. That's your main objective, is to cover your stomach. It's sort of like having another butt. So right away, I let people know that I'm fat, I know I'm fat, and, you know, it's funny. And so that's what you would do on stage as a stand-up. You'd come out and you'd address how you look. If you look like an accountant, you know, you'd address the fact that you look like an accountant. Or, you know, so one of the first things to do as a stand-up comic would be to look in the mirror to get material for your set, is to look in the mirror and see what you see. And then if something sticks out, you know, then that's what you write material about. Now, if you don't want to, like Woody Allen sort of dwells on it, Richard Lewis sort of dwells on it, but you don't have to dwell on it. You could just use it for your opening. Like one of my jokes used to be, I come from a big family. There were 6 kids in my family. We were sort of like the Brady Bunch, except we were black, poor, and pissed. You know, we used to say, screw Marcia, you know. And so I would address the fact that I was from a big family. I would address the fact that I was large and just boom, right away. Now, they couldn't necessarily see that I was from a large family, but still, you know, that was something in my life that, you know, that I would put out there for material. And so the things you hate is really good material. You could go into a long thing on know-it-alls or whatever you pick, like your hair. You could talk about, the definition of a joke is your response to something that happened to you. And so to get joke material out of that, you would maybe write down things that have happened to you. And those things would in turn become your setup, you know. Like I'm legally blind, and I would address that and stand up by saying, I would say I'm blind, I don't see well, I'm not able to drive, so I have to be nice to everybody, because I never know when I need a ride. And then I would say, I'd ride home with Freddy Krueger if he was driving. I'd be in the car with Freddy. So, man, you took your claws and you pull that guy's heart out. Freddy, you're killing me, buddy, you're killing me. Next stop at the right line, you know. Just something that you know, to address all the things that people would see when I walk on stage. Because that's what all people know is what they see, and audiences are very judgmental, and that's all they know about you. They don't really know anything else about you. So is what they see when you walk on stage. So after saying that, is there anything that you would think of, that people would think of, that they could say, that they would make a joke about, that people would see?
Short,
that would be a good one. Some stuff about being short, how that has affected you. Yeah, anything else, anyone else? You can even go as far as to say, I look normal, you know, and you can make jokes about how you would you know, nobody would ever recognize you in a crowd, or nobody would ever pick you out in a crowd because you look so average, so ordinary, if you look that way. A mistake would be to be gorgeous and to stand up and make jokes about how ugly you feel. That would be a mistake. The audience would turn on you in a heartbeat.
Very early on, I saw Drew Carey do a routine. I can't remember what show it was on, but he basically pointed out the fact that when he turns sideways, he looks like those ads for X-ray glasses that they used to have in the back of comic books or whatever.
Oh,
he turned sideways and sees me, and you know, everybody broke up. So yeah. I mean, that was like the first thing out of his mouth when he got on stage.
Yeah, and that's how it's done. People would address you if. If you look professorial, then address that. If you have some kind of disability, there's a number of disabled comics. There was this guy who won, remember the guy who won last Comic Standing, who had the arm that, you know, and when he got on stage, he addressed that. This little Asian guy named, what was his name, Nat Finn or Matt Finn or something like that from Vietnam, boom, he gets on stage right away. There's a bunch of jokes about Vietnamese. I have a friend of mine who's a comic in L.A., and when he gets on stage right away, he's making jokes about being Asian, you know, all the stereotypes. Who's ever heard of Russell Simmons? He's Indian. He's from Canada, and
Russell Peters.
Yeah, Russell Peters. That's what I mean. Russell Simmons is the African American guy. I'm sorry, Russell Peters.
Russell Peters.
He's from Canada.
Yeah,
and he has just a huge following, and he's Indian, and he just makes all these jokes about Indian culture, half of which I know nothing about, but his crowd knows exactly what he's talking about. And he's talking about like Indian parents being cheap. You know, I didn't know that, but everybody else knows it in the audience. You know, he's making jokes about how cheap his father is, and he goes into the dialect of his father. No, we're not going to buy that. You know, and he's and his audience is cracking up, and he has one of the most multicultural audiences you ever wanted to see. You know, just Asians and Indians and just people from all over. And he's a very high-paying comic now because You know, he addressed what he looked like, and he went with that. He didn't go against the grain. He didn't try to be something that that he wasn't. And that's a big thing in comedy is addressing exactly who you are, what you look like, what you sound like. Comedy is based on honesty, and you know, you gotta face that right away. Any questions? Who remembers George Carlin as the Hippy Dippy Weatherman?
You betcha.
Yeah. And he did the Hippy Dippy Weatherman for a while. What was that? Was that on the Smothers Brothers?
Smothers Brothers.
Yeah, he did the Hippy Dippy Weatherman for a while, and then he kind of disappeared. And then he came back as this kind of long-haired hipster guy. The Hippy Dippy Weatherman, he was clean-shaven, and he was just kind of a spacey weatherman kind of thing, like he was high. And but he went, you know, he went back, or as they say, he went to the woodshed, and he did this kind of work. He did the kind of work on things I hate, things that frighten me, things that worry, that I worry about, those kind of things, to get at exactly who he was and how he wanted to present himself on stage. And he came back as the George Carlin that we know. Now with the long hair and the beard, and you know, that's how he finished out his career for years. Who's got the George Carlin stuff?
I do.
Read the.
I've always wanted to be somebody, but I should have been more specific. Where are we going? And what's with this handbasket? If the black box flight recorder is never damaged during a plane crash, why isn't the whole damn airplane made out of that shit? Is it true that cannibals don't eat clowns because they taste funny? Never raise your hands to your kids. It leaves your groin unprotected. If you try to fail and succeed, which have you done? Think of how stupid the average person is and realize that half of them are stupider than that. Why are hemorrhoids called hemorrhoids instead of asteroids? Why is it called tourist season if we can't shoot at them? I'm desperately trying to figure out why kamikaze pilots wore helmets. Do illiterate people get the full effect of alphabet soup? Ever notice that anyone going slower than you is an idiot, but anyone going faster than you is a maniac? The main reason Santa is so jolly is because he knows where all the bad girls live.
So that was George Carlin. A thing about comics also is that comics are usually outsiders, because outsiders are usually the ones who can poke fun of society. It's no accident that many comics are black, or Jewish, or Hispanic, or you know, when you look into their lives, were like either sexually abused or neglected. What's his name? Ray Romano says he'd probably be an accountant if his father had hugged him a few times. You know, so there's a. Most comics come out of this disconnect from society, and that makes it easier to throw rocks at society, because you're an outsider anyway. What do you got to lose? You know. So if you're an outsider and you know who you are, you might want to try your hand at comedy. Let's see. So, a setup. So, comedy is based on two things. What are they?
Setup,
punch.
Setup, punch. And all a setup is information. And all a punch is more information. So, a setup is anything like this. One of the things I hate about myself is, one of the things I hate is baseball caps in church, you know. So that's a true statement. That's information, is baseball caps in church. And then you'd say why you hate baseball caps in church. Maybe, it, you know, what do they expect, the pastor to throw balls at them, or, you know, whatever. You know, you could find the humor in that, you know, by asking yourself over and over again, why does that bug you? What is it about that that bugs you? Who said this? What is it about it that bugs you?
My upbringing, I guess, respect.
It's disrespectful. Yeah. And so you could work issues in with disrespect you know, what does disrespect look like to you? What does that feel like, you know? And just kind of push it to the point of you know, absurdity, where it's absolutely silly. And that's what comedy is about. You push something till it's absolutely silly, absolutely absurd, and then you can laugh at it. And then people can see it for what it is, you know, that it's, you know, that it's silly. They can see the silliness of, you know, of what you're trying to say and what you're getting at. So, the good thing about comedy is that it's very egocentric. It's very much, you can be as selfish as you want to be about it, because it's about you. It's all about you and how things affect you. And then you turn that around and how it affects you, and then you can turn it and say how it affects the world, you know. I can't remember the whole joke, but I used to do this joke about going to weddings and how men have nothing to do with weddings. You know, you can't have a wedding without a man, but when we get there, we got nothing to do. Nobody listens to what we have to say. You know, the women know everything. They know what this means, why you're going over here, why you're going over there, what this candle means, all that kind of stuff. And the men have nothing to do. And I would say, I'd go to a wedding and tell the bride, you know, if you want me, I'll be over there. You know, because we have nothing to do at weddings. And then from that, I went on talking about the difference between men and women in weddings, you know. I babysat for this friend of mine, and her little girl, who was 6 years old, was in the mirror pretending like she was getting married. And her brother, who was outside, he was 7 or 8, he was pretending to blow himself up. And that's the difference between women and men. So I started out a very personal story about me, and then I took it to men and women in general. And you know, and really, of course, that's how a good sermon works. A good story in a sermon, for those of you who are pastors, is you can start off with something personal like that, and then move it out to the larger world. You know what that has to do, because you should. A guy told me once. Professor told me once that people in the congregation are sitting there thinking, so what does that have to do with me? That's what's on their mind the whole time. Was okay. So what does that have to do with me? And it's your job to show what that has to do with them, what this text has to do with them, what this story has to do with them, and you know, and move it outward to where it includes people in that congregation. Let's see. Another one is this thing called never bring your begging bowl on stage. And what that basically means is that you need to know what you're going to say. When you can't go on stage wanting people to like you, you know, that you gotta know what you have to say and say it, and not care if they like you or not, you know. So it's like asking someone out on a date. you don't go up to someone and ask them out on a date and say, would you, you know, what are you doing? Would you like to come to me with me and see a movie? You know, right away, the person's not going to be interested in you. You know, you need to go up and say, I think I'm going to go see this movie. You want to come? You know, you have to know exactly what you're going to do. And I don't know why I'm looking at you two. I mean, you have to know exactly what you're going to do and, you know, and just do it. And let the chips fly where they may and get it out there. So my big question is, I heard Michael talking today and it occurred to me, I think Luther would have made a great comic. And why do you think Luther would have made a great comic?
I think he is.
He was pissed off?
Exactly. One of the things, that's one of the things. He was pissed off. What else?
He was always in a bar.
He was always in a bar?
Self-reflective.
Okay.
Or self-deprecating, to use your term there. Yeah, he always had problems with himself.
Okay.
Always good with a snide remark or so, like just shoved it there.
Okay.
He pointed out things that were weird, that everybody else just kind of accepted.
Wasn't he an outsider?
Yeah.
Egocentric. Never an unpublished thought.
Well, you know, that's another thing I haven't mentioned, but a good comic is obsessed. You know, they're obsessed with their point of view. You know, Rodney Dangerfield was obsessed with not getting any respect. You know, he was just absolutely obsessed with it. You know, Woody Allen was obsessed with, you know, the esoteric workings of the world and society and things like that. Chris Rock is obsessed with the black-white issue, you know. And so, yeah, those are good things. What else? It's a big one that nobody has mentioned. I don't know if I've mentioned it today, but...
He's German.
Germans don't really have a good history with comedians. Although, well, who was it? Hitler's brother was a comic. Victor.
He was Austrian.
Oh, okay. Austrian, or
provocative?
He was provocative, but also he had an enemy. He had an enemy, and who was his enemy? The Catholic Church, of course. So that was his big enemy. So he had a target, and all comics have a target, and a target doesn't have to be a person. You know, when Chris Rock talks about crackers, he's not just talking about one. It's the whole thing. You know, when Joan Rivers talks about men, she's not focused on one man. It's all men. You know, so you got to have an enemy, and he had a great enemy in the Catholic Church, and so. A lot of fiery preachers have a great enemy in sin, or you know. So you gotta, if you're gonna do stand up, you have to have an enemy, and it's got to be a consistent enemy. It can't be the church one minute, and then this person the next minute, and then another organization the next minute. You gotta find that target that bugs you continually, nonstop. All right. Let's see. So who here considers themselves an outsider? Nobody? maybe that's not a good question to ask Luther.
At a Lutheran retreat.
You're an outsider?
Well, I was thinking of being a Christian in the culture. And particularly in a comedy club. An out Christian seems like an outsider.
You were an out Christian in a comedy club?
I imagine myself, were I to be in a comedy club?
Oh, yeah.
On stage as an out Christian? Imagine being an outsider.
Would you do jokes then about,
I don't know,
Christianity? Or
that's the only outsider thing I could think of.
Okay.
Just being a Christian.
Well, you can be outsider on a whole number of issues. What kind of things would make you an outsider?
Politics
would make you an outsider. Although, oddly enough, well, most of the comics are sort of lean more toward the left, which makes them an outsider in society, but not necessarily an outsider in comedy clubs. Hmm. But there is the right-wing guy. What is his name? Dennis Miller, you know who he is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's sort of has turned himself into a right-wing comic. And I don't find him very funny, but I don't find him very funny because he doesn't use any visuals. It's all intellectual, snide comics that he makes. Then, you know, that's just my issue with him. But, that is a right-wing comic. And I have a list, and I forgot to bring it, but there are Christian comics, and some of them are really quite funny, and it's possible to be an out Christian comic. Yeah.
I was just thinking that I think everybody feels like an outsider to some extent. You asked how do we hate ourselves? How do we feel different? And we feel different in these different situations depending on what is our primary cultural perspective. Are we in a different place now? But I think the challenge would be to find yourself, identify yourself as an outsider, that enough people share that identity and you're able to make fun of it in a way that's self-deprecating but not self-destroying.
Of course. And the comedy world is full of that, people who are outsiders in comics for different reasons. Who's got Stephen Wright? Read Stephen Wright.
I saw this.
Wait,
guy.
Do you all know who Stephen Wright is?
No.
Well, he's out of Boston, and he's this kind of esoteric comic.
Excessively droll.
Yeah, and when he does his comedy, he doesn't do any act outs, and he just walks and says, "Yes, it is." And that's all he does, back and forth, saying these kind of things.
Monotone voice.
I saw this guy hitchhiking with a sign that said heaven, so I hit him. When I turned 2, I was really anxious because I doubled my age in a year. I thought, if this keeps up, by the time I'm 6, I'll be 90. I intend to live forever. So far, so good. If I ever had twins, I'd use one for parts. How do you tell when you're out of invisible ink? I went to a restaurant with a sign that said they serve breakfast at any time, so I ordered French toast during the Renaissance. Okay, so what's the speed of dark? Boycott shampoo. Demand real poo. Depression is merely anger without enthusiasm. That's all you got.
All right. So that's him. So imagine this guy with frizzy hair, real thin, just walking him back across the stage like this.
Never changes expression.
Never changes expression. Always has a hand in his pocket, and he's holding his mic, and he says, "I'm something about, instead of shampoo, I want poo. You know, and that's it. That's his act. And so.
Well, see, the opposite is Richard Lewis. I mean, he's the whole angst thing. You know, he's walking around like this going, you know, I can't. Yeah. That's what makes his lines work.
Yeah, Richard Lewis is riddled with anxiety. And, you know, yeah, you're right. He's going back and forth like that. So neither one of these guys on the surface would be considered outsiders. But Richard Lewis's anxiety makes him an outsider. And what makes Stephen Wright an outsider? You know, he just has his head full of these weird thoughts, which we all have. But most of us keep it under control. But he doesn't.
Says who?
Yeah. But, you know, he doesn't. He spews it, and he's walking back and forth, just obsessed. Like I said, excess is good in comedy, and he's just obsessed with this, with these thoughts, you know. Some very, you know, it's almost like he doesn't have a... everything has to be totally real to him. You know, he's just obsessed with this little reality that he has. And so, so in what way are clergy outsiders? And they could use that.
They know it all.
They're know-it-alls? Okay. Not the answer I was looking for, but funny.
I don't know. They're always supposed to be, you know, they always have to do, they can't do wrong in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, they can't be people.
Yeah, exactly. And that's part of the problem with preaching. Is that a lot of pastors, there's no self in there. You know, they stand up and they give a sermon, and there's no self in there. You know, nobody knows. Anybody in the congregation could get up and read that sermon, you know.
But then there are those that have too much self.
Exactly. There are those who go too far. So, you know, it's a balance, you know. But like in all of comedy, and these are the things you can learn, I've learned about preaching through comedy, is that a very big part of comedy is editing. You know, that punchline has to be short and to the point, and it has to end on that punch word, you know. Editing. You know, in the same way with preaching, editing. You know, get rid of, if it's too much of you, get rid of it. It's not about you, you know. And, you know, that's what you have to remember. Unlike comedy, in comedy it's all about you. So if you got that much to say about yourself, you know, give up preaching and go to comedy. But it's not about you when you preach, so you have to make sure you limit, you know, your thoughts on you. But still, you got to have some of you in that sermon. Something of what you like, what bothers you, what frightens you, what worries you. You know, you got to have some of that in there because, you know, people like. To see people go where they haven't gone, you know. When you watch a good professor teach what he teaches, one of the things you want to see is you want to see that professor go where you haven't gone, you know. When you go watch a comedian or when you go, you want to see that comedian go somewhere where you haven't gone. You want to see him say something outrageous, not for the sake of being outrageous, but for the sake of provoking, pushing, moving you in a different place than you were when you walked in that comedy club, you know. So, so anyway, that's what comedy is about, but also what preaching is about too, is moving you and showing some of yourself, in that sermon without, you know, without spilling your guts, but showing some of yourself. Because if people can relate to yourself, it's got to be relatable. It's got to, people have to think, oh yeah, I did that. Oh yeah, I've been there. Oh, you know, that kind of thing. And so, anyway. What else? There are two kinds of truth. There's an emotional truth, and then there's a fact. You know, like, and you have to know the difference. Like, this board is white. That's a fact. Men are pigs. That's emotional. Now, it may be an emotional truth. I mean, it's an emotional truth for many women, I assume. You know, you need to know the difference, because you need to distort it, you know. So you need to take that somewhere other than where it lays on the page or in your head. That sort of thing. What else here? Any questions so far about comedy? Who has ever tried stand up? Nobody? Who's interested in trying stand up?
Well, I said I might try.
Yeah.
I have a guy in a nursing home who would like to try standing up.
He's here all week, ladies and gentlemen.
It's innate, the timing or something. You have to learn that or be born with it, but the timing is what makes it sparkle, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's what people say, but basically the timing is just pausing like you would in a regular conversation, you know. Let me try to think of an example.
Well, I was thinking that when we see something funny from the night before on TV or something, and then you say it around the water cooler, and it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And then you say, well, you had to be there. But
yeah.
Really, you just have to say it with the timing.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, sometimes it's the setup. The setup's not strong enough or not true enough for the people who are there. It's not always the timing. I mean, timing is just knowing when to pause. It's like, take my wife, please. Well, no. It's take my wife, please, you know? And also it's not stepping on your laughs, you know? Some people have asked, what's the difference between, say, like people who know how to be funny, people who are naturally funny, and people who aren't? I find that people who are naturally funny do the obvious thing, which is they don't step on a laugh. They let you laugh and get it over with before they say something else. And oftentimes, people who are not used to being funny, they'll say something and people will laugh and they'll go, oh, wait a minute, you know, and kind of step on the laugh. Well, people want to laugh. And that's the same way in comedy clubs. When people tell a joke, when you tell a joke and you get a laugh, you stand there until that laugh is over. You know, you may do something, but you don't do it till that laugh is over. You know, if you go into an act out, you don't do that until that laugh is over. And that's what timing is about. That's a big part of timing.
And is that something a person learns?
Oh yeah, yeah. If you go to, if you do stand up and you write jokes, you go to the trouble of writing jokes, it's not going to take you long before you realize you're not going to step on your line. That's what you're doing it for, is a laugh, mm-hmm. You know. And most, when you beginning comics, they have a recorder. I used to have a little recorder, And on my way upstage, up to the stage, I turned that recorder on and set it on a table right before the stage, and then get up and do my routine and then get off. And then I'd listen to it when I got home. And I'd pay attention to it, if I had stepped on a line or if I flubbed something or if I messed up punch word or something to that effect, you know. So yeah, it can be learned.
I think that it would have to do with the role you play too. Like pastors, they can be funny in certain circumstances. They can't crack jokes at a funeral. It's not appropriate.
Well,
if it's appropriate in terms of the family that's there, but generally speaking, but sometimes that's when you get the funniest things. But if people expect you to say something funny, they're waiting for you to say something funny. Like every time I see you now around the ark, I'm going to wait for something.
That's okay.
There's you know, you gotta be appropriate. Of course, in a comedy club, it's best if you're not appropriate. They don't expect you to be appropriate.
But they expect you to be funny.
They expect you to be funny. And like I said before, comedy clubs are full of people in their 20s and 30s who are drinking. And they expect you, they want you to step over the line. And clergy, nobody really wants you to step over the line. And like I said yesterday, Garrison Keillor said, people in church don't want a belly laugh. They just want a smile. You know, he said, you know, you don't want to go for a belly laugh because they do a belly laugh and they feel guilty. But if they smile and go, that's, you know, they're happy with that. And also, like I've said before, in a club it's dark and people are drinking. In church all the lights are on and there's no drinking. So there's something about being in the dark when you can't see the people around you. You're less, that's why they do it, you know, you're less inhibited about it. And I don't know, I guess in church they want you to be inhibited. I don't know.
Well, maybe you'll talk about it tomorrow, but it's like the joke has to sort of match the personality that you're giving it, because, you know, some of these Stephen Wright things that was like I didn't read, they just sound like sort of things you'd read in a book, and you would just smile, like, you know, like this, plan to be spontaneous tomorrow. You know, if you read that in the book, it's sort of, okay, that's nice, isn't that cute? But when he's doing it on stage with a plan to be spontaneous tomorrow, you know, and then, you know, it's a lot.
Yeah, well, it's performance, you know. And, when he says it on stage, he's performing it. It's in his own way, that drool kind of way, but, you know, it's a performance, you know. And, you know, preaching is kind of a performance too, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to be village pastor, and believe me, in the summer over there in the VC, that's a performance. Mm-hmm. And everything has to, you got to make sure everything's lined up and in order for that service to go smoothly, you know. And it is a show. I was telling Michael that I was watching this PBS special, and it was talking about the feeding of the 5,000. And this one scholar said that the feeding of the 5,000 was really dinner and a show, you know, because Jesus. I mean, who? 5,000 people came out to hear him. You know, he must have been funny. You know, he must have been, there must have been some humor in the parables. This guy named Capon wrote, he does things on the parables, and he talked about...
Robert
Capon, yeah. And he does things on the parables, and he was talking about how like one of the things Jesus said is difficult. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man in heaven. Well, they were rolling in the aisles because that's funny. You know, we lose it over the thousands of years of translation, but, you know, So Jesus must have had a sense of humor. You know, he must have been doing something to attract the crowds. You know, and you know, he was communicating. He was interesting. He was probably interesting and funny. You know, so you know, it's a performance. You got to put it out there.
Yep. I had a question that there's been times I've felt funny in a group. I feel like so much relies upon the rapport and the level of relationship that's already in existence. And the step to stand up, you know, you start 3 minutes, and you have to develop some kind of relationship, or maybe you don't, but that there seems to be a difference, you know, there's a difference there of being funny with people you know.
Yeah, there's a difference between being funny
with
people you know.
How do you
Well, that's what the setup is about, you know. The setup is a truth, and a setup can be anything. The setup can be, it's just telling what has happened. It's just information. You're just telling what has happened. Like, last night we sang in Vespers. That's all it is. That's all it is. You just lay it out there and let people know. And then the second part of that is the punch. It's some kind of joke that you make from that. But if you're sitting around holding, you don't have to say, last night we went in Vespers. You can say, you know, over there, remember last night when we da-da-da-da-da, you know. You don't have to fill it in because everybody knows what. And so that's one of the differences between talking with friends and talking with, and being on stage. Nobody knows you're on stage. You have to start over. You know, you have to let them know who you are on stage. Whereas when you're talking to your friends, they know all the setups. They know where you're coming from. You don't have to create a character. They know what your character is. They kind of know what your take is on stuff. You know, so that's the difference. All right. What else I want to say? Things I hate. And with comedy, you have to stay in the present. So a lot of times, you know, you can't say, oh, about 3 years ago or something like that. You have to make like it happened then. Like if I tell a joke about going for a colonoscopy, and I always say, you know, the other day I went and had a colonoscopy. Well, no, it was several years ago when I had a colonoscopy. And, you know, so that, you know, that kind of thing. Keep it in the present. And try to have, what's very important is to kind of have a one-line visual, meaning that you use words that paint a picture. You know, you try to paint a picture with what you say, which will make your communication better, and will also give you more of an act out. Like my colonoscopy joke, I talk about laying there after they put you to sleep, and I woke up and I saw the TV, you know. Well, it was actually a monitor, and I say I saw my colon. Now I could have left it at that, but I said I saw my colon, and it looked like a cave, and for, you know, I was so drugged up for a split second, I thought I saw Bin Laden. And, you know, so I had to create that picture of the colon is looking like a cave. You know, I could have just said, if I had just said, I saw my colon, there would have been nowhere to go. But once I said it was a cave, and then at that time, you know, everyone talked about Bin Laden as being in a cave. And I said, I thought I saw Bin Laden. You know, so you have to create pictures that would then contribute, you know, to your act out. I talk about, like I said earlier, about not being able to drive, and that I said, so it's hard to you know, find dates when you can't drive and you don't have a car. So I make up for it by buying fancy shoes. And I when I go ask a woman out on a date, I go, well, you know, would you like to, you know, that. That's all I do is that, and so everybody knows. And I've already created the picture about new shoes, fancy shoes, and you know, that kind of thing. So, and that's another. Once again, that's another thing that that pastors that I learned from preaching. From stand up is that if you can give people a visual, it'll really make that sermon stay with people, because people love visual pictures, and so if you can give them a visual, that's great. Any more questions? Anything you want to know about stand-up? No questions about stand-up at all.
Did you talk about Lenny Bruce at all?
Well, Lenny Bruce, I talked about. Lenny Bruce was one of the first comics who sort of let people into his head. Before Lenny Bruce, it was all shtick. It was all, a couple of guys, guys standing there flat-footed telling jokes that clearly didn't really happen to him. But Lenny Bruce, when he started doing comedy, he started talking about things that were actually going on in his life. He got obsessed with his trial, and started talking about that and obscenity charges that they had against him for using words now that everybody uses. And he brought that into his act. He literally brought his life onto the stage. And he was the first to do that. And then after that, like today, that's just how you do it. You bring your life onto the stage. You take things that happen to you in everyday life, and you bring it on stage. And he was the first to do that. And a lot of people were influenced by him. So, yeah. Is there anything else about Lenny Bruce?
He would have been an outsider, wouldn't he?
Oh, wow.
Close to the
yeah, he was definitely an outsider. And he was Jewish. So, in the 50s. So, yes, he would have definitely been an outsider. So.
Do you think it's true that comics more than, I don't know how to say this, it seems like a lot of comics have trouble adjusting to the fame or success. I mean, Richard Jenny committed suicide.
Yeah.
And then John Belushi, got to die, and then Richard Pryor catches himself on fire, and then, there's just a lot of businesses like that where it seems they're self-destructing.
Well, I think anybody would have that problem with all of a sudden you got more money than you've ever had in your life. And I don't think it's just, I don't think it's just comedians that have trouble with fame and money. Other actors have that trouble too, and so do lottery winners. They have difficulty too. I don't think it's the comedy that makes them have a difficult time. I think it's the money. And if they use drugs, if they use drugs and alcohol before they got the money, they just buy more of it when they get the money, which of course, isn't good for them.
I think often the issue is there beforehand.
Yeah.
And some of that is part of what makes them funny,
is because they're so self-depreciating and they're so, you know,
yeah.
their lives have been interesting enough to get up on stage and talk about. And so I think that's part of what does that.
Yeah, and so it also takes away the inhibitions.
Yes.
Drugs and alcohol take away the inhibitions when you get on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why they use them. That's why some people use them. So. All right. Thanks for coming.
Sounds good.